Bruchim Abayim, Shalom Aleichem. Welcome, everyone. It is a great zchus to welcome all of you, Erev Tov. Wonderful to have this evening the opportunity to get together. Rishus, beloved Chavirim, Rabbi Shai Schechter, the Rosh Beis Medrash, Young Israel of Woodmere, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, the Senior Rabbi of BRS. My name is Reuven Brand, and I am privileged to host you tonight live from Chicago, Illinois, connecting with the five towns, with Woodmere, with Boca Raton, with Amcha Yisrael, with Chavirim Yidim, with Jews all over the United States, to share several powerful insights into the Haggadah. Just want to begin with Hakara Satov. Thank you not just to the Rabbanim, but also to Mrs. Tracy Schultz from our Kollel office and Rabbi Simi Shabtai and BRS for helping arrange many of the technical aspects of this evening. And it's a great schus for me to introduce our first guest presenter this evening, live from Woodmere, New York, Rav Shai Schechter. Welcome, Bruchim Abayim.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Brand, and thank you to everybody who was involved in putting this really wonderful program together. Good evening, Chavera Yedidai. Nice to see both of you, and I'm excited to be a part of this evening's discussion. The Rambam writes words that are quoted quite often when we have discussions about the Haggadah and Leil HaSeder, where he says, "B'chol dor v'dor chayiv adam leharos es atzmo." The Rambam says we have an obligation to envision ourselves as if we are on the journey, coming out of Yetzias Mitzrayim, experiencing it on our own, as the pasuk says, "V'osanu hotzi misham," and HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us, literally us, out of Mitzrayim, and that's the feeling we're supposed to have. I think for most people, when they think about those words of the Rambam, they have an image in their mind of some kind of exhilaration, some kind of bliss and euphoria about the excitement that existed at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of all the Eser Makos and all that took place. But I think there's also an aspect of the story of Kriyas Yamsuf, of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that we relive and we re-experience all throughout the year, perhaps without even realizing it. So what I mean by that is the following. In describing the great miracle of Yetzias Mitzrayim, there's an absolutely astounding medrash. And just to give a little bit of a background, just to give a picture of exactly what it is that the medrash is portraying. So here we have the Jewish people. They're in the middle of the dry land, in the middle of the Yamsuf, standing there together, shoulder to shoulder with all their brothers and sisters, thousands, millions of people. And they're experiencing the most spectacular, the most wondrous miracle that the world has ever experienced, that the world has ever seen. HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed them Yad Chazaka Zra Netuya. This was probably, arguably, the most obvious, the most visible revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence of all times. And yet, the Medrash records a phenomenal conversation that took place on the time of Kriyas Yamsuf, at the time when they were actually in the middle of the Yam walking through the dry land. Listen to these words of the Medrash. Kivan Sheyardu L'toch HaYam. As the Jewish people are walking, are marching ahead through the Yamsuf, and there's dry land. They have dry land in the middle. They have wet on one side, wet on the other. As one would imagine, it was full of dirt and muck and mud, and their arms and their legs and their clothing was just so dirty. They were covered in dirt. It's understandable, after all, just a few moments ago, this was all wet, and there was dirt on the ground, and it was wet, so obviously they're all going to get dirty. Listen to what the Medrash says. You have a family traveling together, walking through, and each one's talking to the other, and Reuven turns to Shimon, says the Medrash. Reuven turns to Shimon, and he says, "You know, this is the strangest experience. B'mitzrayim tit. You know, this is very nice, but let's just try to put it all in perspective. When we were in Egypt, there was dirt on the floor, and we got our clothing all dirty every day, and we went out to work. And now here we are in the Yamsuf, and we have the same thing. In Mitzrayim, we had Chomer Levenim, and now we have all the water on the sides of us, and we're getting just as dirty as we were in Mitzrayim." And that is the conversation that is recorded in the Medrash. It is an unbelievable Medrash in my mind, because I think what it means is that sometimes you could be in the midst of experiencing the greatest, most sublime, most glorious and transcendent experience that you'll ever have. Seeing Yad Chazaka, experiencing Zroa HaNetuya, and yet the very same person who sees and experiences all of that can somehow be so narrow-minded, can be so blind, unable to see the whole set of circumstances that's in front of them, unable to appreciate the gravity and the significance of the moment and the experience that's happening to them in their own lives. You can be in the midst of Kriyas Yamsuf, you can be having the most intimate experience with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, seeing his presence in the most obvious of ways, and yet you can turn to your friend and say, you know, I don't really understand, why is this different than Egypt? And to me, that is a phenomenal insight into human psychology. It's something that really struck me, and that's really what I want to focus on this evening. There is a growing phenomenon that's referred to as denialism. And I saw an article a number of years ago. I actually clipped it and saved it because it was very intriguing to me. The Washington Post about 5 years ago had an article about this issue called denialism. I'm just going to read very few lines from that article. It is just as relevant now as it was 5 years ago, if not more. And they say the following: from climate change to the anti-vaccine movement, their question is denial on the rise in America? In January of this year, an esteemed astrophysicist and a chart-topping rapper went head-to-head in a public debate about the curvature of the Earth. How insane is that? An astrophysicist had to lower himself to go and have a public debate with somebody who knows nothing at all, probably a wonderful person, this rapper. I don't know who he or she may have been, but probably a wonderful human being, probably has a lot of great midos and brings a lot of joy and happiness to the world, but knows absolutely nothing about the fundamentals of physics or anything else in the sciences. And yet, this astrophysicist had to lower himself to go and appear on a public stage to debate the issue about the curvature of the Earth. And what they write is, we are a scientifically advanced society. We have computers in our pockets that do nearly anything we ask them to do. Soon enough, we will have cars that will drive on their own, which obviously since then we do have. But there remains a significant population that does not accept what scientists tell them is true. And they ask, what is going on here? And they get into a whole discussion about why it is that this happens, what the phenomenon is all about. They give numerous examples of how common this phenomenon is and where we find it. But let me just share with you one line that they quote from a professor of history and scientific studies in the University of California. I'm here, she says, with very depressing conclusions. And that is that knowledge is not power. If people don't like the implications of your knowledge, they will resist, they will reject, and they will even attack it. Knowledge alone does not yield appropriate action. We get the idea that if we just tell people what we know, they will change how they think and what they do, but that is simply not the case. This is so relevant to the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, because every time we sit down on Leil HaSeder and we go through the experience of the Esar Makos, and as the Rambam says, we should feel it and we should reenact it and we should do whatever we can to really be in that experience as much as we possibly can be. But I'm struck with the same thought. You know, we have the mistaken impression that just because we sit on Leil HaSeder and talk about all the Makos in a short period of time or a longer short period of time, but maximum it's 3, 4, 5 hours, how long could it be already? We have the impression that maybe all of this unfolded in the span of a few hours. And it's really a mistake. The Midrashim tell us that the Esar Makos took so long to actually play out. It was over the course of almost a year that it took in order for all of this to unfold. But in truth, let's think about it. Here we are in Egypt. Here we are in Mitzrayim, 6 or 7 months into an awfully dreadful experience. You could imagine the country is upside down. And each time that Moshe Rabbeinu has made a prediction, each time that Moshe Rabbeinu has spoken directly to Paro, not only has it come true, but it has come true to the last and final detail of everything he forecasted, of everything he envisioned. It all happened. It all came true. And yet, with an impending cyclone, with a tornado on its way of Makas Barad, here we are, 7 months into this harrowing experience. There was a sizable population that simply could not allow themselves to believe it. So they saw everything that happened, but they just couldn't bring themselves to believe it. Sound familiar to anybody? Think about current events. You know, we see things happening around us and people just can't bring themselves to believe it. And the Torah tells us, Va'asher lo sam el libo es devar Hashem. The person who simply did not take it to heart that God was communicating with him or her. Vayazov es avadav es mekneo basada. And he left all of his cattle, all of his animals, all of his servants outside. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu told us that Barad is coming. Even though we already had dumped Sfardei Akinim Arov and everything happened exactly as Moshe Rabbeinu had predicted. Everything he said came true. And yet the Torah here does not say that these people were not careful about their money. The Torah does not say that they were so wealthy that they were able to afford any type of monetary loss. Surprisingly, the Torah also does not say that they were unaware. Look, there are many people in the world who are uninformed. They don't read the newspaper. They don't listen to the news. They don't know what's happening. Okay, so you're oblivious. You're uninformed. You're unaware. It's not your fault. Or maybe you should have, but maybe you can say it was them, but that's not what the Torah says. We have a community who simply could not allow themselves to accept the indisputable, undeniable, and incontrovertible truth that they knew was true. Va'asher lo sam elibo, an entire land knew it in their minds, but somehow could not translate into anything significant. It could not trigger an appropriate response that would have really made sense for that time period, for that experience that they were all going through. You know, some people mistakenly think, when they think about this issue, they say, you know, what a bizarre, what an irrational phenomenon that we find by these evil, destructive, corrupt, sinful Egyptians. You know, maybe it's just limited to them. It's the Egyptian culture of the time. They were just so taken away from reality. They were so removed from godliness. But I believe that that's really a grossly inaccurate misconception. This has nothing to do with Egypt. It has to do with human beings. I think it's a natural disposition. It's a natural defense mechanism. It's a natural approach that we, who are otherwise thoughtful and considerate, prudent human beings, probably have sometimes. Take, for example, David HaMelech. We know him to be one of the greatest Jews that ever lived. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim, and we learn his Tehillim, and we read so much of what David HaMelech wrote. And yet you think about one of the very uncomfortable stories that David HaMelech was involved with. So David HaMelech sends someone out to battle. He sets his eyes on a woman, and he decides, well, she's an Ashes Ish. It's kind of a problem. David HaMelech was quite a righteous religious Jew, and obviously he cannot marry an Ashes Ish. So what does he do? He sends the husband out to battle, and he gives instructions. Make sure, if you're going to send anybody out to the front lines, make sure it is this man. Make sure that he is going to lose his life if it's going to be anyone, because David HaMelech had a plan here. Now the Gemara says maybe it wasn't his fault, and if you're going to say David Chata, you're making a mistake. But if you read the Psukim very carefully, without any interpretation, it seems that something went very, very wrong here. And so much so that it required Nasan HaNavi to come and stand up to David HaMelech and have a conversation with him. So what does Nasan HaNavi say? He says, you know, let me tell you a story. He doesn't want to come out, guns blazing. He doesn't want to give him Musar. So he says a very nice thing. He says, you know, David, I just want to have a conversation with you. There was once a man who had a very wonderful neighbor, and they had a really nice relationship with one another. And one man was a very poor man. He really had nothing to his name. And the other one lived not the impoverished lifestyle of his neighbor, but he had an abundant, plentiful lifestyle. He had everything he could ever ask for. And he had an inn. And people used to come by. And part of the deal was that when you come and you sign up to sleep in the inn, you also are provided with a hot meal. So one fine evening, he takes a guest into the inn. And he notices that he doesn't really have anything to serve him. So he goes to his next door neighbor's backyard. And this poor man who really has nothing to his name, he's destitute. All he has is one little sheep. And he goes next door to the neighbor's yard and he steals the sheep and he slaughters it and he prepares it for the meal and he serves it to his guest. And Nasan HaNavi turns to David HaMelech and he says, what would you think the punishment for such a man should be? And David HaMelech turns in disgust and he says, Ben Mavis Ha'isha Zeh, what? How can you do such a thing? Don't you understand? You took away the one item that's meaningful to this human being. You have to destroy his life. Look how much you have, and you have to take away the one thing that your friend has. It really doesn't make sense. And David HaMelech is railing against this man. And finally, Nasan HaNavi looks him in the eye and he says, Atah Ha'ish, do you understand? You are that man. And the mashal that I just gave you is a description of your own life. But sometimes you could be the great David HaMelech, you could be a very thoughtful, a very wonderful human being, you could be a very pious human being as well, and yet somehow it's very difficult to put ourselves into that narrative and to appreciate the set of circumstances that sometimes we have created for ourselves. And that is what we can perhaps take away when we read the story of Paro Melech Mitzrayim and we look at this bizarre, irrational response that they had and we say to ourselves, how is that possible? We look at the story of Reuven and Shimon who are walking through the Yamsev and talking to each other and saying, you know, what do we need this for? After all, we had dirt on our clothing when we were in Egypt and now we have dirt on our clothing again. And the answer is, you got to open your eyes and see the set of circumstances in front of you. Appreciate what God has given you. Understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to impose yourself and to really understand, Atah Ha'ish, you are the person who is experiencing life, and you need to take advantage of that life and understand what those circumstances mean for you and for all those around you. Let me just close. I know we're pressed for time, so I'm really just going to close with this one final thought, and that is the following. On August 1st, 2014, it was just 2 hours after Hamas had agreed to a ceasefire that was brokered by the United States as well as the United Nations. There were terrorists who ambushed 3 Israeli soldiers, and this became, unfortunately, a famous, or I guess the proper word is an infamous story, because they came out of a tunnel and they snuck out of a basement somewhere in Gaza, and they killed, unfortunately, 2 soldiers at the time, and they shot Hadar Golden. Hadar Golden at the time was a 23-year-old lieutenant. He was part of the Givati Brigade, which is, if you're not familiar, it's one of the elite combat units in the IDF. And they dragged Hadar Golden's body through this tunnel and they kidnapped him. It's been almost 7 years, and Hadar Golden, unfortunately, is still not back to his family. He's still not back to where he should be. And that's a painful tragedy. It's a painfully tragic story to think about. Since that time, they have been unjustly holding his body. But what I want to focus is not on the tragedy, but on something absolutely amazing. I remember at the time, there was so much said about Hadar and what kind of personality he was. I think the thing that struck me most was when his family said on his gun, it said, "Ha'oz v'ha'anava l'chai olamim." What a perspective, what a human being, what an amazing soul. And such a person who's given as a sacrifice on behalf of the Jewish people. Lo aleichem v'lo aleinu. We should never have any more sacrifices. We shouldn't know any more of this tragedy. But what an amazing human being. But let me just take you back. You know, sometimes we hear these stories after a person is taken from us. Let me take you back, not to when Hadar became one of the Kedoshei Ha'am, one of the great and holy martyrs of our nation, but let me take you back to when Hadar was only 17 years old. And at the time, he served as a madrich for a Snif B'nai Akiva in Kfar Saba. So he felt that as the madrich, he felt that as the counselor, he had an obligation to share some kind of message, a powerful message to all the young students that he was teaching, or all the people he was interacting with. And he wrote them a letter between Purim and Pesach to prepare them for the upcoming, for the impending Yontif of Chag HaPesach. Again, 17 years old. This is not a Bava Maase. It was written 5 years before anything happened, before Hadar was a famous person. This was an amazing letter that he penned, and I'm going to read it to you. Tov, and he writes the following. Avarnu et HaPurim v'anachnu mamash lefnei HaPesach. We made it through Purim, very exciting, very beautiful time in the Jewish community, and now here we are on the cusp of celebrating Pesach. Hadavar hamiyuchad Purim lePesach. If you want to notice what is something that is unique and singular, both to Purim as well as Pesach, as opposed to many of the other holidays that we celebrate throughout the year, it is Sheshneim Meleim B'Sipurim. Both Purim and Pesach are filled with stories. The main highlight of these holidays are the story that we think about as we commemorate the great miracle of Purim and Pesach. And anachnu kulanu nihiyim misaprei sipurim. Somehow, when it comes to Purim and Pesach, even if you're the most dull of personalities, somehow you become transformed into a storyteller. Somehow you're a narrator, even though you don't really know how to generally tell stories and it doesn't normally interest you. But who doesn't tell the story on Purim about Mordechai and Esther and Haman and Achashverosh? And who doesn't tell the story on Pesach about Paro and Moshe and Aaron and the Jewish people and Kriyas Yamsev and all the Makos? It's an amazing story. And yet, this is really supposed to be our focus. And this is what it's all about. What we should take from this is, he writes, B'chayim shalanu. As we go through this experience of Purim, and we transition into Pesach, and we focus on the storytelling. Listen to this beautiful insight, such a powerful insight from such a pure soul. B'chayim shalanu, in our lives, yesh harbei sipurim, we have so many stories. L'kol achad yesh et ha-sipur shalo. Every person, every individual has his or her own story. B'chol ha-sipurim, and don't forget, said Hadar Golden, that every one of these stories, hem chelek mi-sipur ha-gadol shel amenu. All of our personal stories are just one small part of the greater story of our people. Shemovila tasipura gadol shel historia. Our little story, whatever it might be, at whatever juncture we're up to in our lives, is something that is able to advance and to evolve the story, the greater story of the Jewish people, which he says started with Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, David, Shlomo, and all the greats of our people, and now achshav anachnu. You go to the end of that chain and you understand, I am a part of that eternal story. B'sipur hazeh, he writes in this story, kol echad yachol lahachlit. We have the ability to decide, as we're focusing on storytelling, when we come to Chag HaMatzos, when we come to celebrate Pesach, we have the ability to decide Am I going to be Hadamut HaRashit? Am I going to be the essential, the vital, the indispensable, and the crucial, necessary character in the story of the Jewish people? What role am I going to play? Am I going to be the Gibor, he writes? What powerful words that he says about himself. Am I going to be the Gibor? Will I be the hero? Will that be my function? Am I going to be the person who is that necessary character who is vital to the story of the Jewish people? Or am I just going to be the unnecessary, the trivial personality who just lives through it and doesn't really have an active role in anything that happens? Life just passes me by. Hasipur cholef liado. Things happen, but I don't even bother to open my eyes and realize this is part of something bigger. There's a bigger context to all that I'm going through. Hayim atam movil et hasipur shelcha, and he challenges us as we come to Chag HaMatzos to think, am I moving ahead my own individual story? Hayim hasipur shelcha hu sipur tov, am I making sure that my story is a positive and productive one? Hayim hasipur shelcha mechubar li sipur shel Am Yisrael, am I making sure that my story is somehow connected and linked and associated and related somehow to the Jewish people? Does it advance the story of the Jewish people, or am I just living in a reality where everything passes me by and I don't take one moment to really pay attention to what that story represents, to what that story means, and to how vital and integral my part in the story is? Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is a chance for all of us to be reminded of the sacred and eternal story of the Jewish people. It's a chance for us to remind ourselves, like Nasan HaNavi tells David HaMelech, we have to point to ourselves every once in a while and say, Atah HaIsh. You have to see yourself as that individual. You are walking through the Yam Suf. You are the one who's there in Mitzrayim experiencing the Esther Makos. And you need to turn to yourself and say, that is me. I see the context of all that's going on around me, and I internalize the message of what it means, not only for now, but for the greater whole, for the greater contribution of what the Jewish people are all about. And most importantly, Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim reminds us that we have the opportunity, that we have the ability as individuals to write the next chapter of the story of the Jewish people that is just waiting for us to carefully craft it and to carefully write it. I wish all of you a Chag Kosher v'Sameach, and I look forward, as I hope all of you are, to hearing the great next two presentations that we're about to hear. Chag Sameach to everybody.
Chag Kosher v'Sameach, thank you so much, Rabbi Schechter. I'm delighted to introduce and welcome Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, the senior rabbi of BRS of Boca Raton Synagogue. Bruchim Haboim, welcome, v'chavod gadol.
Thank you so much, first of all, Rabbi Brand, for hosting, for organizing, for collaborating, for your friendship, for your leadership. It's a great schus to be able to collaborate and do this together. And Rabbi Schechter, I thought about forfeiting my slot. I could have listened to you for another 20 minutes and 20 hours. Thank you for your passion and thank you for your insights. I really want to build on not the same theme, but I want to build on the notion of the meta theme. To me, the Seder night, it's so critically important that we not lose ourselves in the minutia and the micro, in the gematrias and the arts and crafts projects, which have a place at Shabbos lunch. They have a place for us to review and take in and appreciate, but they're not the meta themes that are meant to be the foundational conversation pieces of the Seder. If Seder night transforms us, if the Chassam Sofer's insight that we make the bracha on Maggid at the end, because just like the convert can't make a bracha over La'asiyasan, and we too are to be transformed by the experience of setting ourselves free and being set free, so the bracha is Asher Ga'alanu at the end, then the themes that we talk about have to not be the Divrei Torah that are trying to impress or that are highfalutin or that are complicated or that are drawing from the width and breadth of Torah, but meta themes that get us talking about what is freedom and what is slavery and what does it mean in our own lives and how is it part of our family narrative and story and how does it craft and how does it shape my destiny? And that was what Rabbi Schechter so beautifully discussed, one meta theme, and I want to share with you another. One that resonates a lot for me in our time. I think that people are speaking, it's hard to be alive today and not be exposed and aware to these conversations. The notion of cancel culture, the notion of a world that's monitoring our speech and trying to limit it, filter it, hold people accountable. And I'm not weighing in politically on the whole movement of a cancel culture, certainly not on Dr. Seuss or Mr. Potato Head or anybody else. I don't want to talk about other companies or other icons. I want to talk about us. What does speech and the power of speech, something so fundamental to the freedoms of this country that we are blessed to live in, how does it connect to our ideas and ideals of what freedom is really all about? it's very interesting that Chazal generally, regularly, discourage us from being too talkative. Emor ma'ad vaseh harbe, say Chazal, say little and do much. We all know there are two types of people, the talkers and the doers. There are a lot of people who talk a lot and do little, but Chazal say be the opposite. Emor ma'at, speak very little, vaseh harbe, and let your actions do the talking. And Chazal add, v'chol amar bedvarim mevi chet, if you're verbose, if you're loquacious, if you just unfiltered speak on and you let everything come, maybe chait, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to sabotage your relationships, your happiness, your success. So generally speaking, the Jew is cautioned not on speaking, but on silence. The great Mashkiach Ravolba points out that we teach a child how to speak and we celebrate. They said the first word, they said Zayda, they said Abba, Mommy. We get so excited, we applaud them, we encourage them. But do we ever teach them to stop speaking? Do we ever encourage, do we ever reward silence? Or once they stop talking, they never stop. So generally speaking, but Pesach is the exception to the rule. Pesach is all about talking. Gemara tells us matzah is called lechem oni, lechem she'onan adarm harbe. There's a specific mitzvah of magid, to tell sipur, tell a story, speak, and don't be succinct, but rather, take as long as you want. Go all night. Don't stop speaking. Dwell on the story and elaborate on the story and delve into the story. So what is it about Pesach that we have an entirely different attitude? Our mode changes. What we admire, what we aspire for shifts so radically from an attitude of listening twice as much as we speak to an attitude of don't stop speaking, don't stop sharing. Viktor Frankl in his Man's Search for Meaning describes what happened after they were liberated. On Shabbos HaGadol, I, like many other rabbis around the world, spoke about the notion of the chabura, of being together as a group, and why that's so intrinsically connected to freedom, the willingness and the ability to share. A slave scrounges, a slave selfishly only is caring about their own success, their own continuity, their own survival. An expression of freedom is an ability and a willingness to share. And that's what a chabura is all about. And we saw an entry from Primo Levi and from another Holocaust diary about that transition from the Holocaust to right after, the willingness to share. But Viktor Frankl also sees an enormous transition upon liberation, not in the willingness to share food, but a willingness to share something even more personal. He writes, "The body has fewer inhibitions than the mind. It made good use of the new freedom from the moment on. It began to eat ravenously for hours and days, even half the night. It is amazing what quantities one can eat. And when one of the prisoners was invited out by a friendly farmer in the neighborhood, he ate and ate and drank coffee, which loosens his tongue. And then he began to talk, often for hours. The pressure which had been on his mind for years was released at last." Listen to his words, Viktor Frankl. "Hearing him talk, one got the impression that he had to talk, that his desire to speak was irresistible. I have known people who have been under heavy pressure only for a short time to have similar reactions. Many days passed until not only the tongue was loosened, but something within oneself as well. Then feeling suddenly broke through the strange fetters which had restrained it." He describes a person who's imprisoned, a person who's in a concentration camp, a person who's in servitude in Egypt, a person who's in the captivity of their body or even of their own mind, fails to find expression. There's an existential loneliness. There's the consequence of speaking freely. Person has these restraints and these filters. They're unable. And the affirmation that one is free, the indication that one has been liberated, is now this desire to speak. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal, in his book, The Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind, writes, "Upon delivery from Mitzrayim, the Jewish people regained their self-expression. As long as they were subjected to Egyptian bondage, their self-expression was stifled and suppressed. But at that moment of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jewish people regained speech. Slaves can't express or assert themselves properly. They cannot realize their potential. Only the free man is capable of doing so." The Igra Dekala on Parshas Beshalach points out that when the Jewish people cry out to Hashem from the oppression, the persecution, the suffering, the pain, they can't even find words. They can't formulate or articulate. It's a groan, it's a moan, it's a krechts, it's a scream, it's a yell, it's an ouch. Because the koach hadibur was in gullus. They were unable. When you are enslaved physically or spiritually or psychologically or emotionally, when you're in a dark place or a lost place, when you are unable, when you're stifled, when you're unable to express, then all you can do at best is krecht. The best you can do is issue a groan. Long before Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Arizal, and his Pri Etz Chaim and Shaar Mikra Kodesh, and Perek Dalet, saw the connection between freedom, the ability to be set free, and the ability to speak freely. And he saw that in the very name of the Yontif. Pesach says the Arizal famously comes from Pesach, a mouth that speaks. Because the mouth was in Golos, the power of speech was in Golos, it was in exile. A person who's at work is afraid to speak up. A person in a certain social circle, because they're concerned for the consequence, stifles and silences their own words. That's not freedom. Freedom is the ability to communicate, to converse, to articulate. Part of our very affirmation of our freedom on Pesach is affirming the awesome responsibility that comes with freedom of speech. And that's part of what makes this great country an exceptional country. Israel celebrated its biannual seeming event today of yet another election. Democracy, the one we live in, the one, please God, soon we will merit to live in. These democracies, the First Amendment in America promises free speech. Free speech means we have the ability to protest or advocate or object. We can speak our minds. We can speak our minds. But the Torah's view of free speech is very different than what American liberty provides for us. Because even though we have a freedom reflected by our ability to speak, we're not allowed to use that speech to incite or to libel. You can't use it for obscenity or to plagiarize someone else's words. There are rules and regulations around how we express, how we use that power of speech, as fundamental as it is to freedom. Yahadus Torah, Judaism also believes in the freedom of speech and sees the capacity to speak as one of the greatest expressions of our freedom. American law tolerates speech which is negative, which is insensitive, which is tactless. That's what we're seeing right now. Who should have a right? Bernie Sanders today agreed with Donald Trump, something that probably hasn't happened or won't happen again in a long time, when he said he believes that the past president should have the right to be back on Twitter. One of the fundamental freedoms of this country. Again, I'm not weighing in politically. I'm afraid to even mention names today. That's how unfree we are to even the assumptions that will be made about us. But they understand that there's a freedom. And America gives that freedom even when it's negative or insensitive or tactless. When Justice Lewis Brandeis affirmed the freedom of speech in a Supreme Court decision in 1927, he acknowledged that such liberty made possible what he calls, quote, the dissemination of noxious doctrine. Noxious doctrine. We don't believe in that. We, and this is what I want to communicate, that the Yom Tov, the Chag of Pesach, Pesach, this great freedom, this great privilege, this great responsibility, this great opportunity to have that power of speech, what differentiates us from animals, doesn't give us a freedom of speech of noxious doctrine. Paro says the Maor V'Shemesh, Paro is Osios Pe-Ra. He's the Sitra Achra. Paro is when you use the power of speech to be a despot, a dictator, to make others suffer, to torture, to oppress. It's the power of speech in its worst form, to hurt and to undermine, to destroy, to marginalize, to judge, to make feel lonely and apart. Torah, in contrast, our Torah has no patience for noxious doctrine. Not only are we prohibited from Lashon Hara, whether it's true or untrue, right? Everybody, it's true. I'd say it in front of the person. The rules and regulations for how we use this gift, this freedom, we are enjoined. We have to be mindful in our choice of words. Our speech can't be noxious. We measure the acceptability of speech by a very different metric, whether it's Lashon Nekiyah, Mazel Tov to those who made a Siyum HaPsachim. At the very beginning, the Gemara talks about a Lashon Nekiyah, the importance, Behema Tahora and Ena Tahora. Our speech has to be clean and proper and concise and elevating. Can't use speech that hurts or profanity that degrades. The Rav Yaakov ben Asher, the author of the Torah, provides a method to understand the Jewish calendar called Adbash. Aleph goes with Saf, Beis with Shin, and so on. And he notes that the Aleph, which represents the first day of Pesach, is always the same day of the week as the Tov, when Tisha B'Av occurs. So if you want to set your calendar, you don't have access to Ma'izmanim, if you know what night of the week Pesach starts, now you know when Tisha B'Av is going to fall. The Beis, the second day of Pesach, is the same day of the week as the Shin, as Shavuos, and the Gimel, the third day of the week of Pesach, is the same day of the week as the Resh, as Rosh Hashanah. And parenthetically, it's been pointing out, though the Torah obviously doesn't go this far, that the seventh day of Pesach always falls the same day of the week as the Ayin, which is Yom Ha'atzmaut, the fifth of the year. Whatever connection there is between Kriyas Yam Suf and that miraculous day. So Pesach and Tisha B'Av are always the same day of the week, and they share this close association, which seemingly is much more than just coincidental. And some suggest that on Pesach, when we are denied and deprived the ability to bring a korban Pesach, we should be acutely aware and remember the loss of the Beis HaMikdash l'Churban, and not only that it's not there, but how we got there. So we eat neg, the symbol of mourning. And we remember how Hillel used to eat the sandwich of the matzah and the marah together when the Beis HaMikdash stood. But the Grav of Vilna Gaon was very opposed to seeing mourning as having any part of Seder night. Seder night is regal, it's royal, it's being free. We're not invoking images of mourning and of grieving and of sadness. So why would Pesach and Tisha B'Av be the same night of the week? What is the connection? Rav Avim Shor in his Lekach Ve'Alibov suggests that we open the Haggadah by saying, Kol Dichven Yesev Yechu, whoever hungry, come and eat. It is the most disingenuous invitation of all time. And this year, maybe it's a little bit more authentic, but if you recall last year, everyone's door was locked, everyone's window was hermetically sealed, no one was allowed within 50 feet of our home, or we thought we could die on the spot. There is not a more disingenuous invitation than pronouncing, everyone's welcome, there's plenty of room, please come, join, while the doors are closed and the windows are sealed. You want to be such a grace at tzaddik? A week before Pesach, post online, stand up and clap at the end of shul and announce whoever should come. So why are we saying, Kol Dichven Yesev Yechu, whoever hungry, come and eat? What is really going on? So says Rav Avraham Shor, Kol, anybody and everybody, you're all invited to my Seder. Not literally and not formally, because I know it's not an invitation you can take me up on, but I'm communicating more about myself. We begin our Seder by recognizing the power of speech and how we want to use it. We start the Seder, says Rav Avraham Shor, not by saying, this one's puzzle, and this one's no good, and this one's too from, this one's not from enough, and this is the shul I daven at, and the shul I never step foot in. We do the opposite. We begin Seder night by using the power of speech to pronounce, kol, everybody and anybody, the right of me, the left of me, more religious, less religious, those who voted the same, who voted differently than I, we're all going to sit together. Kol dichvin, everybody. We are misakein, we correct and repair the damage of Tisha B'Av. Destruction results from abusing that power of speech. And Geula, redemption, only happens when I use the power of speech to build bridges and to create connections and to repair the world that I'm in. It's what differentiates us as human beings from animals. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, Vayipach ba'apav nishmas chayim, the Targum famously, Ruach Mala, he gave us the ability to speak. And some of the Svarim HaKadosh and the Chassidish Svarim point out, this is also true on Seder night. When we were in Mitzrayim, we couldn't daven. We couldn't find the words. We didn't have the time, and we didn't have the self-awareness or the margin, the space, the mindfulness to connect to our Creator, to the Almighty. We were suffering. We didn't even believe Kotzei Ruach Avodah Kasha. We had so little faculty of vision, we couldn't even believe or dream of a better future. Pesach is the ability to speak also means not only to one another and how we speak to one another, but it's pointed out, Adam Arishan is given this power of speech. It's what differentiates him from the animal kingdom. And yet, there's no one to speak with. There are no other human beings yet. This androgynous figure has not yet been divided. So to whom was he meant to speak? Why was he given this faculty and this power if there was no one to share it with? And the answer is there was. The Ribono Shel Olam. The core and essential purpose of the power of speech is tefillah, is to talk to Hashem. Oh, it also happens to come in handy to talk to your spouse or your children or your friend or at work. But the primary and central purpose for the power of speech is Hashem. That power was in Golos when we were in Mitzrayim. We couldn't find the words and we didn't have the energy. But Pesach, we have the ability to speak, to take advantage of that which differentiates us, to renew the promise to use speech, not in a way which results in a Tisha B'Av in destruction, but a kol dichvin, everybody. I love all Jews. Afas Yisrael, come around my Seder table. Not literally. I'm not inviting you. I am just displaying and demonstrating at the very beginning of the Seder how I use my power of speech. The Kav HaYosha writes in Perek Tzadik, one must recite the Haggadah deliberately and joyfully. He says you can't say the Haggadah like it's a burden. You can't be farbissina, and you can't be flying through it. You can't be mumbling it. He writes that the word maged has a ring similar to the word meged, which means that something sweet, it's pleasurable, like Rashi in Dvarim Lamed Gimel. We have to be, our speech should be pleasing and it should sweeten other people's lives. Magid should be said with Megid, not flying through it, using and utilizing the power of speech. Kol Hamarbe, speech is who we are. It defines that freedom, how we use it. Lo Yachal Dvoro, you can't turn power of speech into chulin, into something profane, into something secular. It should be something which is Kodesh, which is holy. Too many around us are filling our world with their noxious doctrine, with their caustic and bombastic tone. Too many people are filling the world with hate and judgment. They are destroying it. They're bringing churban. The Haggadah reminds us it's not just what we say, but the way we say it. It's not just saying magid, but saying it with megid, with sweetness. before Pesach, this week we are rushing to finish cleaning our homes, but on Pesach we clean our speech, and we remember that the freedom that we enjoy and that we're blessed with comes with the responsibility for a Lashon Nekiyah. That on Pesach, sitting around that Seder night, it's only, not only important what goes in our mouth, but equally important is what comes out of our mouth and how it comes out of our mouth. It defines us. And particularly as these issues are being debated and defined in our day, let us remember that we have a tradition and a legacy that offers us its own definition of what it means, the power of speech. We should be zocha on this Pesach for our Pesach to return to a tefillah that is sincere and authentic, genuine and real, to use that power of speech to build bridges, b'chabura, as I feel so privileged to share tonight with my dear colleagues, and to unite Woodmere, Boca, and Chicago. I thank you for this opportunity and wish everyone a chag kosher v'sameach.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Goldberg. Beautiful words. Rabbi Schachter began talking about the meta theme of internalizing. Rabbi Goldberg talked about the meta theme of the power of speech. I'd like to turn to a different meta theme for tonight to focus on an additional component to take away for our Seder, and that is the goal of creating a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the Seder. To do that, I'd like to introduce you to an incredible person, an inspirational living legend who is in Ottawa, Canada. And to do that, we could begin at the end, because many of us in our Haggadahs, in our Siddurim, the end of the Magid, the end of the whole Seder concludes after we put away all the dishes and cleaned up the table and everything. It concludes with Shir HaShirim. In many Haggadahs, many of us have the minig to say Shir HaShirim at the night of the Seder. And even if you don't have that minig, we're going to say it over Chol HaMoed. We're going to say Shir HaShirim on Pesach. And what I want to understand is, in what way, how is Shir HaShirim the capstone of the Haggadah? Now, Shir HaShirim, of course, is a story. It is a song. It is a description of love between these young people, between this couple, between this man and this woman. It's the story of a marriage. It's the story of two people coming together. Shir HaShirim Asher L'Shlomo. Shlomo Miloshin Shalom. Being together. L'misha HaShalom Shalo, says the Heilige Sfas Emes. That there is this unity. There is this couple that is together. It's the Shir HaShirim of Shlomo. I imagine at the end of the Seder, for those who have had this experience, I imagine that this is like, for those who have had it, to be the parents, I can ask Rabbi Goldberg, to be the parents at the end of their child's wedding, right? What is it like to sit down and to look at your spouse at the end of that night and to have that special time, that special relationship? That's the end of the Seder. That's the Shir HaShirim. That's that time with us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What a relationship we've built over the evening. But the challenge is, how does the Haggadah, how does the structure that we've been given, the Seder, that order, how does that nurture and build a relationship? And perhaps the more difficult question, and it's very sensitive, especially for various individuals, is that this relationship on one level seems to be, unfortunately, one-sided. There's an imbalance. We say at the Seder, Ilu lohotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, had HaKadosh Baruch Hu not taken us out, you know, we were so far, we were in the Memtes Shari Tuma. Had he not rescued us, we would be lost. He did it all. He looked at us and he said, Va'at Eirom Ve'eria. We were completely bereft. And not only was it then, every generation, B'chol Dor V'dor, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Miyadam. So how do we have a relationship which is so one-sided? How is there a union when one party is doing kimat essentially everything and the other party isn't contributing much at all? How does that work? How do you navigate a real relationship when it's so unbalanced? So on one level, you could say, look, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in this relationship, the Ratzon HaTov Lahitiv, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Kulo Tov, and he just wants to give. And so when I raised this with my Rebbe Muvik in psychology, Dr. Pelkovitz, he said, you know, I've been at Camp Simcha and High Lifeline retreats many times. And he said, there's so much Simcha there because the counselors and the staff and the whole environment, they want to give to the children, to the campers. And even though on some level, perhaps you could say it's a one-directional relationship on some level, when the campers allow the counselors to give them a great time in camp, everybody feels good, which is probably true. I totally get that on one level. But on another level, I wonder if it's still wanting. What does it mean that a person should always be in a relationship where we're always getting? How do we feel about ourselves in this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So I called someone else who I thought might have insight into this question. And again, it's a very sensitive topic. Everybody in their own relationship, in their own series of relationships, deals with this differently. But this person has a unique insight. And her name is Shandel Symes. Shandel Symes from Ottawa, Canada. She is a Rebbetzin, an incredible teacher, an inspirational role model. And on June 20th, 2010, she was driving home to Ottawa with her husband, with her seven of her eight children at that time. She was 7 months pregnant. Her husband, Rav Yehuda Symes, is a well-known Rebbe. He was a Rebbe in the day school in Ottawa. He was also the founder of Torah High, the NCSY program. He's an old Chafetz Chaim Talmud. He was 42 years old at the time. And they're driving at night from Rochester back to Ottawa. Yehuda was tired, Rav Yehuda, so he moved to the passenger seat and Shandel took over the driver's side and she was driving on the highway and it was dark. And at the last moment, she saw right in front of their van, she saw a deer in the highway, right in the headlights, right in front of them. And instinctively, she grabbed the wheel and she turned it. And all of a sudden, the van started to shake back and forth. And Yehuda was dozing. He woke up and he tried to help her straighten the wheel. But the van careened out of control and it slipped over the side and it started flipping over time after time. And lo aleinu, the van ended up off the highway in a ditch. And miraculously, all of the seven children who were in the car got out okay. And Shandel was 7 months pregnant, also got out okay. But Rav Yehuda in the passenger seat, his spine was crushed by the roof of the car. And he was unable to move. And he became that night the rolling rabbi. The rolling rabbi. Because he became, lo aleinu, unfortunately, a quadriplegic. And he was taken back to the ICU in Ottawa, where he was able to some degree, recuperate mentally and emotionally, but physically, he remained essentially paralyzed. For a period of time, he was able to use a little bit of his body, but he largely communicated verbally, but also at some points just with his eyes. And while they were in the hospital, he was in the ICU and Shandel was downstairs in labor and delivery. She delivered their son and he was there. They celebrated the bris and their life changed dramatically. And she wrote afterwards, and she has been writing, and Amir Tzashem, she's putting together, she's submitted to various publishers the manuscript of an incredible book, what it was like to have that new life with a husband who was on a physical level always dependent on her and others and aids and care. So she said on one level that her marriage and the expectations in their marriage, they changed. But I spoke to her last week as I was thinking about this idea, and what she shared with me was so powerful in thinking about what it was like to have a marriage in which the expectations and the way that they related to each other was very different than what it was before, because he had such a difficult and challenging disability. And she said what mattered to her was the feeling, the awareness of his expressions of love. That sometimes, she says, even at points where he could not speak, but he could just raise his eyebrows, his eyes, and communicate something to her, even non-verbally, how much that meant to her, to know that he was there with her and that he loved her. That was the key for her marriage. That's what she shared with me. And when she shared that, it struck a deep chord, because there was a very wonderful marriage therapist here in Chicago who is an old friend of mine who sang at my wedding, at our wedding. His name is Josh Martyr. He's a licensed marriage therapist. So he once gave a seminar on behalf of the Kollel about relationships, and he distilled the nekudos, the three core principles of marriage, of what he works on with couples, to three yesodos, three messages. I see you, I hear you, I'm connected with you. And he used those three yesodos to explain exactly how couples communicate with each other and build a healthy marriage. And so I understood how when Rebbetzin Simes, when Shendel Shetichye, when she explained to me what it was like to be with Rav Yehuda, together with him, even if he couldn't speak, that he was communicating with her sometimes non-verbally. I see you. I hear you. I'm with you. At the Seder night, we say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I see you. I hear you. Thank you. Alachas kama v'kama. Thank you so much for this. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Barditcher points out, we call this Yom Tov Pesach. He, kivyachol, with a capital H, the Ribbono Shel Olam calls it Chag HaMatzos. We call it the whole week Pesach. It's not even Pesach. Pesach is over after Yom Yudalit and at night. But we call the whole week Pesach because Pesach is what he did for us. Chag HaMatzos, we did for him. But we focus on him because we tell him, we see you. It's all about you. We thank you. We sing to you. Even at the end when we tell stories, Chag Gadya, Chag Gadya, it's all you. We think of you. Rabbi Friend Shalit has a great vort, especially for those who are familiar with growing up in Baltimore. He says, you know what it means, Echad mi yodea. If you were to ask a kid, if you were to ask me growing up, if you have to ask Rabbi Friend, as he would say in his inimitable way, walking down Park Heights Avenue, what is the number 8? So Rabbi Friend would instinctively tell you, number 8, there's only one number 8. Shmona mi yodea. Cal Ripken, Shmona ni yodea. If you wake someone up at 4 in the morning in Baltimore, they say Shmona is Cal Ripken. So Rabbi Franz said the goal at the end of the Seder is that when you wake someone up in the middle of the night, you say to them, Echad. You say, Echad lo ken yashav shemayim v'aretz. Shnayim, you ask them, what's two? What's two? They're traveling on us. Two? Oh, Havara, two is the Luchos. We say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm there with you. I recognize you. I appreciate. I see you. Vayar Yisrael Sayara Gadola. I'm connecting with you. I'm singing the Shira. And so in that way, even though Kiviyachla Kadosh Baruch Hu is giving us everything every day, Macharish Betuva B'chol Yom Tovin. And so on the one hand, there is an asymmetry here. On the other hand, there is a symmetry in the relationship by us contributing our half by saying, I see you, I hear you, I'm with you. And in that way, when we get to the end of the Seder, by saying thank you and giving that recognition, it becomes sheer Hashirim. Says Rav Avram Tzvi Kluger, Shlita, one of the great Mashpiyim in Israel today, great thinkers in the world of Chassidus, Rav Kluger points out that it's the Shirim, it's two songs that become one song. It's his song and our song that become together. And so even though our contribution is a little bit, B'damaya Chayi, yes, we did the Bris Milah, we did the Korban Pesach, we cleaned our houses, but Ribbono Shel Olam, he gives us everything all the time. But that little bit says so much. It communicates something. And that's what builds the relationship. Amazing story. Shendel shared with me, and she said everything I could share with others. And if anybody wants me to put them in touch with her, reach out to me afterwards. My email address is rbrand@torahchicago.org. I'll share with you a picture of this couple, this beautiful couple at that time. Here's Rav Yehuda, and here's Shendel. So she shared with me that it was on their anniversary. It was in 2013 when it was time for their anniversary. And Yehuda was back at home. And you see he had this special wheelchair. So she said that a guy knocks on the door. And he's there. It's 2013, their 21st anniversary. He's there to paint. A painter is there for a painting, to do painting. So you can imagine this woman, she has 9 children. She's got a husband who has severe challenges. She needs to, she says, Loch and cup, lozen, the only thing, what do you need? I didn't order anybody to paint the house. There's no painting. So one of the kids comes and says, Ma, no. The painter says he was ordered. He has to come or he has to paint. She says, what are you talking about? So one of the kids points to Yehuda sitting in the wheelchair and he can't speak, but he's nodding. And he had a special keyboard that he could control with his eyes. And he's nodding. Yes, the painter. So she comes to the front door. She says, what's going on? The man says, you know, someone called me and said, I have to come here and do a portrait of a couple because it's their anniversary. And as they say in Hebrew, nafala simon, shechaptois, that Yehuda had sent a computerized message to a friend of his who hired this painter to draw a caricature. So she runs upstairs, she gets dressed, she comes downstairs, she sits down, and for their anniversary, they had a painting of each other. Because she recognized and she felt that he just wanted to say, I love you, I appreciate you, I'm with you. And that was what he could do in that way, in that moment. That's why building that connection in whatever ways, that's what's meaningful. That's why the Medrash says in Shir HaShirim Rabbah right at the beginning, Shir HaShirim, it's the Meshubach Shebashirim. Because all he wants to know is that we love him. That's why the Medrash describes that he sent us a little message. The Medrash describes he sent Malachim to send us the message. Do you love me? Do you want to do my mitzvahs? And we sent back, yes, we love you. We want to do our mitzvahs. He was so excited. Just those little mitzvahs that we do, just by saying, yes, we're going to eat a little bit of matzah, just by acknowledging the Rabbonu Shalom, by doing those small things, it goes so far. So the Medrash concludes in that section, Yishakenu Minashikos Piyu. In 2017, in February, Rabbi Yehuda Zichrono Livracha, he passed away. The last year of his life was very challenging, and he couldn't speak, and he was very limited. And yet, the Rebbetzin, this iron beacon of strength, of light, Shendel said that even during that last year when he couldn't speak, she still felt his love. They still had such a close and beautiful marriage. At the end of the Leil HaSeder, we finish Shir HaShirim, we finish all of the Magid and all of the stories and all of the Dalet Kosos. And we sit down, and for those of us who have the minig, if you don't have the minig, there's no iser to try it on. For size, you could say Bli Neder. If you never want to do it again, you could try it if you're full, you know, half asleep. But even if not, just think to ourselves and ask ourselves, what's our relationship like with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? We finish Shir HaShirim, we have to make sure that the Seder has brought the two of us closer. We feel so good, hopefully, at the end of the Seder. Yes, maybe we're tired, maybe some people drank a little bit more wine than they're used to, so they feel a little bit woozy. But hopefully that Shir HaShirim is that feeling of the chasen and kala as they're sitting together at the end of the wedding, just taking it all in. Or the parents of the chasen and kala looking at each other. And if that's the end, that's how we began, beginning with the end in mind, for us to understand that's the goal of the Seder. So let's make sure that every part of the Seder is building toward that. That when we say al achas kama v'kama tovu mechupelas lamakam aleinu, we realize that we're building that connection. We're speaking not just about him, but to him. We say to you, Baruch Ata Asher Ga'olanu, you took us out. We're saying Halo B'Shas Hanes to you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're making Kiddush with you, with the Shechina, the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is at our Seder. At each step of the Haggadah, each step of the 15 steps of this Seder, let's make sure that we are building that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because that's what the Seder gives us. It gives us the 15 steps to create that relationship. And yes, on the one hand, it's he is Kol Yachol, he does everything. But on the other hand, he wants, Yishakenu Minashikos Piyu, he wants us to have that marriage relationships. He wants it to be mutual, and it becomes mutual by us investing in the relationship, by us telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the Seder, I see you, I hear you, and I'm connected with you. Halavai, all of us, in our own ways, in our own Seder, will be able to nurture that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu during the Seder, at the end of the Seder, when we say thank you, when we recognize you, and we can build that connection. Look forward in Mirtz Hashem next year, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim, to get together with all of the Jewish people, with all of our Chaver Medidim, with Rabbi Schachter, Rabbi Goldberg, all the Chaverim here in Chicago, all the Chaverim in Boca, in Woodmere, in all of Klal Yisrael, to be able to enjoy Bias Gold Tzedek, V'nochal Sham, and Azvachim, and Apsachim. We should be able to celebrate so many Simchas, Nachas, Gesund, good health, Besurus, Tovos, be able to internalize, as Rabbi Schachter said, the incredible miracles that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does for us all the time, and to express that in a positive, constructive way, as Rabbi Goldberg said, that we should celebrate Lashana Haba, B'Yerushalayim.